Hello and welcome. Thank you for listening. My name is Sarah Baumert. I am a yoga teacher, Feldenkrais practitioner, and host of the Sarah B. Yoga podcast. The Sarah B. Yoga podcast and my practice, Body Matter, is an interdisciplinary learning space where we explore the many ways that movement can help facilitate body acceptance and awareness, reduce pain and stress, regulate the nervous system, and build strength and ease. My teaching plays with the synthesis of Feldenkrais awareness through movement lessons, traditional yoga asana, creative imagery, breathing exercises, self-massage, and a compassionate mindset to help you feel a greater sense of ease and comfort in yourself. Sarah B. Yoga and Body Matter have a lot of other program offerings. These podcasts are just a taste of my teaching. Each week, I teach a range of online classes, including a gentle yoga class, a level 2 class for more advanced students, and Feldenkrais classes with monthly themes, anatomy lessons, and Q&A sessions for more in-depth study. I have 2 new courses starting at the end of February. One is my continued Monday night blending of yoga and Feldenkrais class. This series will have a focus on the pelvic floor, the psoas, and the abdominal complex. Each class will use pelvic floor mapping as an entry point for a well-rounded practice. The second course is The Secret Language of the Arms, where we will explore Feldenkrais lessons that offer the hidden potential within the upper body. You might imagine this scenario. You go to just grab your phone and check on something, and before you know it, that kind of gripping action of your hands, of holding the phone, starts to create a tension that travels up your arms, to your neck, to your jaw, to your chest. You might even realize that you've been holding your breath and you're somewhat lost in this digital world as your body braces. And for what, really? We've all been there, uncomfortable with the tension that comes from our technology, where the strain travels from our fingertips up through our arms, into our shoulders, our chest, even to our foreheads. And none of us are immune to these kinds of modern day scenarios. So in this series, The Secret Language of the Arms, each lesson will include 2 components. We'll move from microcosm to macrocosm and connect the dots along the way. So you can think microcosm, an exploration of the articulation and functional coordination of the smaller joints, like the fingers, the wrists, the elbows. And then we'll expand outwards, discovering how your arms integrate with the whole self, feeling the way your spine, your ribs, even your legs and your feet, how they contribute to the harmony of the movement of your arms. No Feldenkrais lesson is complete without an integration of the whole self. While there will be this focus on the upper extremities, these will be whole body lessons. You can find a link for these 2 new spring courses that start at the very end of February, beginning of March. Find all of that in the show notes, or just visit body-matter.com. I hope to see some of you there. Okay, on to today's episode. Welcome to the Sarah B. Yoga Podcast. This podcast is an intersection of my yoga teaching and my training in the Feldenkrais method. This is a bonus interview episode with Pamela Seelig. So I won't be teaching class today, but for yoga students, new and old, I think it may be interesting for you. Pamela recently published her first book, Threads of Yoga. And in this interview, we discuss the spiritual aspects of yoga, what it's like to start out as a yoga teacher, the responsibilities of a yoga teacher and student, and how yoga can be a doorway to a meditation practice. And then generally, we discuss how one can use the body to be of service for regenerating a connection to the spirit. I think this interview will be interesting for both yoga teachers and students. And something I have never done on this podcast is to talk a little bit more about my own experiences as a teacher and my training and philosophy around teaching yoga and other somatic practices. So you will get a little window into that as well. Pamela was a pleasure to speak with, and I hope you enjoy this interview. Hello and welcome. Today I'm here with Pamela Selig, who is a yoga teacher and author of the new book, Threads of Yoga, Themes, Reflections, and Meditations to Weave into Your Practice. Welcome, Pamela.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. So glad to be here.
Yeah, so your path to yoga and to yoga as a career is interesting. It maybe is not exactly what you expected to happen. You were working in corporate America, and you were diagnosed with Bell's palsy. And as you were healing from Bell's palsy, you found your way to meditation. And then from there, eventually yoga. All that correct? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Bell's palsy is when I woke up and half my face was paralyzed. So it's very dramatic, not life-threatening, but I couldn't do anything. So a nice doctor recommended meditation, which I'd never done before. And I think like a lot of people, it's something unusual turns you in this direction, that I really was, you know, full steam ahead, working on Wall Street, and kind of hit the wall.
So eventually you went to study at the Integral Yoga Center in New York City. Yeah. Yes. And interestingly, that same year, I think it was 2006 that you were there.
That's when I did my training. Yes.
Okay. I was training the same year a few blocks away at Om Yoga.
Oh, wow. So yes, I know that studio too, or knew it. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's no longer there. But yeah, I was just envisioning us both kind of walking around Manhattan trying to, you know, figure this whole yoga thing out. I was quite young then. It was a very exciting time in my life. But so we've both been teaching yoga for about the same amount of time. And, you know, when I think back to when I started teaching yoga, it seemed to be gaining a lot of popularity, but it was nowhere near as prevalent as it is today. So I guess I'm curious about your path to become a teacher, this shift in careers, and then how that led to writing this book in particular. To me, this book reads as a resource for yoga students who have an asana practice, but maybe haven't quite found their way into the philosophy or some of the more contemplative aspects of yoga. So yeah, what was your motivation to write this book, and what was that career shift like? How has that been for you?
Yeah, well, it definitely, in 2006, yoga was definitely not trendy. I remember friends and family were sort of like, what are you doing? And but what happened was, when I started meditation, again, it was sort of a weird time where I couldn't go to work. It was pre-internet. So I dove in. Now, of course, I teach, you know, when you start meditation, maybe 10 minutes, it's fine, build up. I didn't know that. I just would sit, you know, for hours. And I had some experiences that I understand now, but at the time, I really didn't. So I was fascinated, wanting to find out what the heck was going on, and found the answers in yoga books, which I was like, wow, how come I don't know this? It was quite normal. It wasn't that fantastical, but it was pretty unusual. So I was fascinated that, you know, when you meditated, you have this energy, this prana, and it can move and create, you know, different sensations in the body. And again, I was like, why doesn't everyone know about this? And why didn't I know about this earlier? And learning about it really helped me to heal. I felt it speeded up recovery. And, you know, I started to see, I stayed steady with meditation, and I started to see the dramatic changes for me and how much it helped me, like in my practical day-to-day life. So it just spurred me on to learn more and more. And I wanted to like let everyone know, like, meditation's really great. You know, people should do it. This is what it does for you. You know, now, of course, there's scientific research. Every week a new study comes out. So it's really being backed up. But back then it was sort of a little wacko, but it just helped me so much. That's what spurred me on. I wanted to learn more. And eventually did do some training, not necessarily thinking I would teach, just because there was nowhere else to learn. Like a teacher training was the only place you could learn. And Integral Yoga Institute teaches Swami Satchidananda, the founder. He really taught a lot about the Yoga Sutras written by Patanjali 2000 years ago. Your readers obviously all know that. I mean, listeners, sorry. And that to me was like, wow, this is like a handbook for life. It lays it out fairly kind of simply and yet quite profound. And when I got into the movement, to the actual postures, I was also amazed at how bringing awareness into the physical body could, you know, that was really affected my life as well. So there was all these overlapping pieces. But the Yoga Sutras, I really felt had information that everyone should know. And I tried to weave information into my classes in the beginning, but most people are there for the physical posture, so I didn't want to bring too much in. But trying to weave this information into classes was challenging for me. And I was always looking for a book to help, to like, you know, give me some good quotes and some themes and some backup. I would make the class my own, but I needed some support. And I never really found that book. Also, students were asking for more information than they could learn in a typical class. And I really didn't have a good book to point them to that was sort of general. So that's why I wrote the book. I just really felt like this information is helpful for teachers trying to use modern language in a modern context, but also for students who, you know, want to learn a little bit more, maybe not ready to delve into the ancient texts or to take a teacher training, but to just learn like a little bit more. Why are we meditating? You know, what is a chakra? What is present moment awareness? Those sorts of things. So it was quite rewarding and enjoyable to write.
So I feel as though when I first started teaching, I had a similar experience, was working to weave things, philosophy into the practice. And I actually think I did it more when I was younger than I do now. And I could see how this book could be really helpful for that and for students, because it's a bit much to maybe start with a translation of the Yoga Sutras. Although I have one translation I love and I go back to it. And like you said, it's quite simple in many ways, even though there is just, it's so rich as well. Yeah, so I've been thinking about this and how in my own teaching, it's shifted a little bit, and I felt almost more confident when I was at a certain point in my teaching to teach more philosophy. You know, some of my students have been practicing with me for almost 20 years and like my whole time span of teaching, and so they clearly appreciate the practice. And yeah, I don't feel like I get into the philosophy too deeply at all, but I still think there can be a spiritual aspect to it. So I think, you know, some students might have a different spiritual or religious practice, but those practices aren't always body-centered. I have this question around, or maybe just want to have a conversation with you around teaching asana, which, as we know, is just one of the limbs of yoga, versus teaching yoga. And I was thinking about this, like, you know, when we're teaching the yoga as we know it today, as most people know it today, that's called yoga, like maybe it should be called asana, right? You know, it's not like most classes aren't including all of those limbs. So that was just kind of like a thing that was going through my mind. Even though I think the asana practice, depending on how it's taught, can have a very spiritual aspect to it. And that the asana can reunite students with their spiritual life through their body. And I think, you know, your book, it's not that it's not saying that. It's certainly saying that. I actually, can I read a little bit from it?
Oh, absolutely.
This is you're talking about your sister. There are many levels to these subtle inner states. My sister Sue tried yoga, hoping it would help relieve tightness in her back. Afterwards, she called me and asked, "Does yoga make you happier?" She was walking her dog after an online class and found herself whistling. She said, "I never whistle." I knew what she meant. What kept me steady in my practice early on was the inevitable bad mood that would crop up if I missed a few classes. If I did yoga, I felt happier and was a less grouchy mom. At first, I didn't necessarily care why I felt better. I just knew I did. So I am really curious about that kind of experience that I think a lot of students have where they feel the effects, like the asanas work. We kind of like, we know that they work. And some students may be like, "That's fine. That's enough for me. I get the benefits that I need." And other students may really kind of want to dig a little deeper into that.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Here's how I think about it. But I think everyone can, you know, take these teachings and mull them over themselves. And because my personal opinion has really dramatically changed over the years and may change in the future, but grounded in the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali, he tells us yoga is the quieting of the mind. And then the next sutra, he says, and then the seer abides in her true nature. That's why we do. We quiet our mind so that we can know who we are. Now, then he tells us how to quiet the mind. There's this eight-limbed path. Now, you don't have to do all the limbs to reach ultimate self-realization. You could take one little aspect and of the limbs, and where you're drawn to, we're all different. We all have a different roadmap. But I don't necessarily like the word mastering, but you know, taking an aspect and really delving deeply with that. So it might be pranayama, breath work. It might be one of the ethical precepts, maybe nonviolence. It may be asana. And I think for our culture, asana is so valuable because we have to be sedentary. And also because most of us are very disconnected. We're in our head, in our thoughts. When you practice this body or movement or asana, it connects you back into your body. You have that mind-body connection. You're no longer in this thought stream that most people are in. You're in your body. So practicing asana is about, and as well as all of the limbs, awareness. So we bring our awareness into our physical body and do these movements and stay there and breathe, going deeper and deeper and deeper. That's a spiritual practice. There's no, if you do asana, that's not a superficial part of yoga. That's one of the limbs. And you can take that and just go as deep as you want. But I think what I'm trying to say in this book is yoga is not just the postures. Many people think that's what yoga is. Actually, yoga is the quieting of the mind so that we can know who we are. How to quiet the mind is asana, is pranayama, is the ethical precepts, is meditation. Those are the Patanjali's maps that he gives us to quiet our mind. Why? So that we can know who we are and live in that space of that, our potential. It's such a beautiful thing. So I think we just have it a little bit backwards, or most of us, myself included. You forget, it's not just about getting the perfect triangle pose. It's about being aware and remembering, you know, reconnecting to who we really are.
Yeah, great. I love that. I love that idea that you could take any aspect and really focus in on it. And obviously with the kind of chronic anxiety that so many people are feeling right now, bringing some awareness and a body-centered practice to it is so important to just begin that quieting. I know that, you know, in the last few years, the last 2 years, you know, since the pandemic, teaching, there have been some, you know, some days where just I can sense the anxiety, even when I'm teaching online, the anxiety in the room, it's almost palpable. And, you know, I'm living in Minneapolis, the global epicenter of the social uprising, which was activated after the murder of George Floyd. And so there were some like really incredibly charged moments for myself included when I was teaching online. And it felt to me like anything I could do to help people calm their nervous system was the best use of my teaching. And so like bringing the focus, the awareness back to the body when it's so activated like that, when it's in that, you know, sympathetic fight or flight state, so that the students could actually just begin to connect a little bit deeper into what they needed, right? It's hard to even know what you need and be able to listen to yourself when you're in that place, when there's like so many layers of anxiety or so many layers of thoughts that are covering that up.
It's like the student, they'll meet you where, or I guess you'll meet the student where they're able to be at. For some, it's just getting out of that chatter, just a little bit, getting that little bit of rest from the chatter is like magic. And for others, they may be really experiencing some very deep states. They've got a lot of experience, they're in their body, so I think providing the asana is incredible in these times. It's an incredible gift, I think.
And you also talk about in your book I think this is a bit for teachers to perhaps bring up some of the philosophy during Shavasana. And I love that because, you know, you've already, the physical practice has happened, you're in this more quiet, you know, still place, a little bit easier at that point to get below the thought stream, do a body scan, something like that. So, yeah.
I think at some point, especially if you've had students for a long period of time, they are interested in what's happening. They know what's happening. They can feel it. They know their day is dramatically altered after a yoga class. And then to understand, I think in Shavasana, you can help people to notice their thoughts and be the observer, be the witness, feel who you are. You know, not, you are not the thoughts, you're the observer. And like something can click. And after a while, I think students really crave that information. Like, oh, wow, I've heard that you are not your thoughts, but I never really experienced. I didn't really know what that meant. And then I actually deeply experienced it in a class. And I think even beginner, actually, you know, often in Shavasana, beginner students have a real experience. I think it's amazing. A lot of people, I think, feel that you have to have like, you have to be like a advanced yogi, or you have to be a holy person, or to have these kind of mystical experiences. But I found that's not true. They're for everyone. I think that's our birthright. Once we quiet the mind, we can really experience, you know, these states of really just who we are anyway, that just gets covered up by our chatter.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree that it's available for everyone. Yeah. And so, okay, as I was thinking about this, I was thinking in general about how yoga has changed so much in our society and how many teachers there are and how prevalent yoga teacher trainings are. And, you know, you made a really good point that when we were doing our first trainings, that was kind of the only way that you could get more information, that you could go a little bit deeper. And I know a lot of people still do teacher trainings, not with any
thought that they're going to teach, but just that they want to learn a little bit more and go deeper into their practice. And, you know, I have a little bit of a, I'm not sure that I trust that 200-hour teacher trainings are quite enough to become, a full yoga teacher. I'm not sure what word to use. And there are a lot of very young people becoming teachers. And, you know, I did my first training when I was like 22. So we all start somewhere and then mature from there. But I know, like, when I was in my 20s and teaching, I was pretty hesitant to teach philosophy, especially when I was teaching to students who are maybe 20 years older than I am. And a lot of my students have stayed with me. So there still is that age difference, but I've grown and matured, had more life experience. So, you know, it may feel a little bit more appropriate for me to teach philosophy. But, you know, I often refer my students to other meditation teachers they might find inspiring, just because I know it's not necessarily my strong suit or what feels natural to me. I'm a real anatomy person. I'm like, I get really into the subtle aspects of the poses, not in an oppressive way, but definitely in an exploratory way. And that being said, I think even just giving a little seed of something to a student, like in Shavasana, or, you know, still working with the body in service of regenerating this connection with the spirit. But yeah, I'm curious how you feel about that in terms of, like, very young teachers, you know, being put out there, and what that does to the philosophy.
Yeah, I felt the very same way, where when I was a new teacher, I guess I was intimidated, but I just didn't want to, like, I thought, like, who am I to share this, like, this incredible wisdom, and I didn't want to mess it up. And I also didn't understand it that well, and I knew that at the time. I thought it would be just terrible to sound preachy, like, to sit and, I just dreaded that, you know. I just was lucky that I had had so many amazing teachers that shared the information, and I was so fascinated, and it spurred me on. So I felt like it was sort of my duty, in a way, if I'm going to be a yoga teacher, to share this yoga information, that I was almost, you know, gypping students by not sharing it. However, I think you also have to do what feels natural to you. We're all different, and we all have our strong suits. But I think that every teacher should at least talk a little bit about meditation in the context of yoga philosophy. So maybe you're a brand new teacher and you don't want to talk about, you know, the sutras and get too deep into that. But maybe, you know, once a month, say, we're going to take 5 minutes or 10 minutes at the end of class today, and we're going to meditate. And I'm just going to teach one, you know, basic meditation practice that you can bring home, and you could do it at your home. And this is why we meditate. So after class, it's because I remember people want physical practice. And if you start the class right off with a big meditation, you get a lot of eye rolls and a lot of people not happy. So I feel like it's something to say at the end of class. I also really believe that in these times, this current time now, people want to meditate. They try, they can't do it. They think their mind is too busy. But I think with all these research studies talking about the benefits of meditation, almost everyone now says, gee, I should meditate. But it's very challenging, and yoga class is a great way to learn. So that might be a way to bring in some of these teachings that expand a little bit more from the physical practice. But I think you have to think about it, and think about what kind of teacher you are, what kind of teacher you want to be, and you know that your students probably want this information just like you did.
I very much appreciate that answer. And Teaching meditation at the beginning of the class when minds are really busy is much harder than teaching it at the end of class. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Keeping a meditation practice the last 2 years has been really challenging for me. It was much easier when I had a community. I could go and like have actual place that I, you know, left my home. And, you know, I kind of find that surprising in a way because I like being home. I have a space for meditation. But I do think it's pretty challenging for a lot of people right now. You know, do you have any great tips and tricks for this moment in time?
Well, I think that most students who try meditation, or people who try meditation, I would say like 90% say, you know, I tried, but my mind was too busy. My mind is too busy, you know, and I can't do it. And I just think it's like, I'm not flexible enough to go to yoga class. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's actually part of meditation. When you realize how busy your mind is and you can't meditate, that's what your mind says. But realizing how busy your mind is the first stage of meditation. And that's good. Like, you're getting it, you know? So I try to tell people that if that's why, one of the reasons why you're not. And then of course, when you go a little bit deeper, sometimes the memories come up that you don't want to visit, and the deeper stuff comes up. So that turns a lot of people off right there. That's uncomfortable. And so, you know, the rest of the percentage of people are usually like, no. So that leaves like less than 1% that actually sit down and meditate. So again, I think knowing that helps, because I think we all have a mind, and really the mind's job, I feel, is in a way to stop you from meditating, because the mind will then cease to exist, and it knows that. So I always, you know, when I'm going to meditate, and of course it'll start like, you can't, you're too busy, you need more rest, whatever the excuses that come up, I just think, wow, you know, the mind is doing its job, but the mind isn't in control, hopefully, all the time. The mind is a great tool that we have, but it's that deeper part of ourselves that should set the direction and the tone. And hopefully that will get us to set up our own strategy that works. And sometimes it may be less time meditating, sometimes it may be more time, but we can pick it and then have the choice to stick to it. And I think nowadays, I feel like we all kind of do have to be a little bit easier on ourselves and give ourselves a break and notice if we're not meditating as much. And I just think the fact that we're noticing that is an elevated state. It's not just you're in it, going around and around, you know, the rat race or the running on the treadmill. We're stepped out, we're noticing, and that's all we can do. And I think everyone just has to give themselves a break too, now and then.
Yeah, some nonviolence towards yourself, for sure. I have I have plenty of awareness of how busy my mind is and how I can distract myself from meditating or make excuses. I have a lot of awareness about that, Pamela.
So I pat yourself on the back.
Yeah, I at least have that. I know it's you know, it's one of those things where when you get out of the habit of it, it can be hard to get back in. But I think that oftentimes if people haven't meditated much, there's an idea that it's supposed to be this really kind of peaceful place. And I, you know, every now and then that might be the case, but it's often for me pretty, you know, tumultuous, and there's a lot of processing. And I guess it depends on, you know, what kind of meditation practice you're working with, but often students also feel like they aren't supposed to think, like they can't think, right? Versus like you talk about in your book, being an observer, like getting to that place where you can see your thoughts. You're not trying to like push them away, shove them away, get rid of them, like noticing, okay, what's showing up. And then in that noticing, it's probably going to shift. And then continuing to notice, oh, okay, it's shifting. And just that observer mind that you speak about. Yeah, so I think there's some really great core ideas about meditation that you talk about that, yeah, there may be some misconceptions that people have about meditation. So I really appreciated that in the book.
Yeah, I think for sure. And I think, you know, for people that do a lot of asana, you know, it really does help the meditation practice. You know, if you're drawn to meditation, I feel like if you don't do asana, you just like are a regular person in the world and you sit down to meditate, it's probably one of the most challenging things you'll ever do. Asana, if you have an asana practice, you get it. Like, you know, you're in an uncomfortable pose, but you know you can relax and breathe and the sensation's there and it's uncomfortable, but you're safe and you're aware. And that's a lot of, I think it's very similar to meditation where you're sitting and sometimes it's very uncomfortable, but you're sitting and you know it will pass. And so it's not that peaceful. And it's not, I think a lot of people think meditation is when you stop the thoughts, and that just isn't, it's quieting down. I always forget to say that, like it's just quieting down. You don't have to be perfectly quiet, just quieting down. And there's lots of great techniques because people have been doing this. You know, we have evidence people were meditating 5,000 years ago. So there was a thing then, like, you know, we still are trying to quiet our minds. It's not like this is something everyone that you should be able to do right away. It's a lifelong practice.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking about this idea of some students that I know, some friends that I know who are much more interested in a movement practice, a yoga practice that's synthesizing tradition or a more post-lineage perspective, students who are, you know, looking to decolonize their bodies, to remove this idea of authority from their inner life, from their body. So this idea that rather than following a really strict tradition there, or strict tradition that's rooted in lineage, which, you know, we could argue that the yoga practice is, that they're more interested in this idea of inquiry and exploration. And I think there's a lot of that happening in movement practices. And I also teach the Feldenkrais method, which is a much more kind of open field when you're moving. It's the awareness piece is super key, but there's not as strict of a, like, here's the shape we're going for. It's much more about exploring what shows up for you. And I feel like even in that kind of exploratory way of wanting to practice, there still is space for this quieting of the mind. I mean, I think it can happen still. Yeah, have you been seeing any of that? Or can you talk a little bit about that in regards to like your research for the book? You know, I'm guessing that you've done a lot of your own practice and research and reading into this philosophy that is steeped in a lineage. And so just how to kind of grapple with that. And in a way, what I feel like you have done is, you know, have made it your own, made the philosophy your own with the book. Yeah, so maybe speaking a bit to that and how students can kind of weave something that is coming from a lineage and not have it feel oppressive in a way for them.
I love this topic so much. So when I started practicing yoga, I remember when I saw Integral Yoga Institute in New York, it's an ashram in the village, West Village, and I saw the sign above the door. It said, one truth, many paths. And I just was like, thank you, because I was raised Catholic, and I was told a lot of things, and I just didn't buy it. I love the deep, you know, teachings of Jesus and if you practice kindness, love your neighbor, I love all the teachings, but it was the around that, the rules, they just didn't resonate with me. And I certainly didn't want that from a yoga practice. And so when I saw that, I was like, okay, good. I'm not going into a place where they're going to tell me I have to do this and that. But I really loved the teaching. Swami Satchidananda, what I loved about what he taught was, it's not the teacher, it's the teachings. Because I was a little nervous about that guru mentality as well. So that really drew me in and gave me a nice basis of yoga philosophy, really from the Yoga Sutras or from like an Araja yoga perspective. But then I did trainings in Vinyasa, Ashtanga, Iyengar. I love them all, honestly. And I feel like, you know, especially some of the, like Iyengar, the strict movements, like they really helped. And they gave me information and showed me ways to experience the poses in a new way, perhaps. But after a while, what I came to the conclusion of, and this is just my opinion, but I really felt like it wasn't so much the specifics of the pose. Now, with safety, you know, when you have to be safe and you have to understand basic anatomy. So I'm not, you can't do anything you want, any movement you want, but in a safe way, and it's not like a triangle pose, so many different ways to do triangle. When you're in that pose and you're being, the teacher saying, press the big toe down or the left hip, you know, everything, and you're doing it, it's about the awareness of it. It's a way to come into your body and experience the pose a little bit, maybe deeper, maybe not. But that's what these movements are about. It's being so aware. So when you go to another style class and they tell you the actual opposite thing, a triangle, and you're like, wait, how can that be right? Well, it's not about right. It's bringing your attention to the knee this time or the right hip and feeling it in a different way. And a light bulb went off for me. Like, it's about the awareness of the movement and also where you are in your life. I think certain styles are for maybe younger people, certain styles are maybe for older folks. But when you stand in mountain pose and you have to bring your big toes together, and you have to bring, you know, when I started, it was big toes touch, heels slightly separate. And then I went to a class 5 years later and they're like, feet hip distance apart. I was like, excuse me, I understood after a while, feet hip distance apart felt a little better for me. But it just brought my awareness into the body. And so I don't think we should get too caught up in the different lineages however, I think they all are magical and have so much to offer. And I think a lot of it also depends on our own personalities. Some personalities are naturally rebellious and they don't like being told certain facts. Other personalities, I need to know this information and I need to have control of the information so that I can do the pose. And, you know, that type of personality is more drawn toward other lineages. So, that's what I've seen over the course of the last, I guess, 3 decades of practicing. And I hope to learn more in the next couple of decades, mm-hmm. But it's about awareness. As long as this, you know, there's a certain amount of information, a benchmark has to be made about safety. It's about awareness and creativity and going deep enough so that you actually feel what's happening in your body and you can move based on that more than what an outside teacher is telling you. They're guiding you, but you are really in your body feeling it the way that you need to feel whatever movement you're doing.
Yeah, I always say to my students, trust your body more than you trust what I'm saying. Because exactly. What I'm saying is they are just these benchmarks for where we're going to, and that there isn't a perfect pose or you know, a right or a wrong way, really. And yeah, something that Feldenkrais said, which is really similar to what Swami Sachidananda said, was you are your next teacher. He really wanted to be sure that there wasn't this guru mentality and that the method was much more about you learning from yourself. So I think what can be hard, though, is if there are students who maybe aren't confidently going into a class with that, like, knowing this is about me listening to my body and listening to what I'm needing. And then if there's a teacher who maybe isn't as open to that, or it does have a little bit more of a strict discipline, which, you know, some lineages do have that. That doesn't mean that those, you know, those teachers can also have this exploratory way to teaching. But, you know, if a student enters into a class where there is like a really strict protocol, and maybe they don't have the confidence to go, oh, except I maybe don't have to listen to that one thing because it hurts my sacrum or something like that. Yeah, right. Like you can get into trouble in that way. I mean, I've had that experience myself, even though I knew better as a student, where, you know, I was injured because I just, like, I'm the kind of person who's like, I'm going to do it the way, you know, I'm a dancer. It's like dancers often have this mentality of you're told to do something with your body and you do it. And it doesn't matter if it hurts or if it, you know, it's just like you do it because otherwise you don't have a job. And so I, you know, for a long time, even in my yoga practice, as I was studying, I had that same mentality because I didn't know anything different. I didn't realize, like, oh, my body can feel good. It doesn't have to be about pain or like pushing too far. I can actually look for what feels interesting and what feels enjoyable and what brings ease to my body rather than going to the extreme. So that's what I'm finding a lot of people are much more interested in, that kind of a practice, and younger people too, which I think is really hopeful in a way.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's a fine balance as a teacher, you know, when you get, you know, how much to, some students walk in and they have no idea, you know, what is yoga about? So you have to have a certain amount of, like, be a container for this information and say, be competent. Like, I'm a competent teacher. You are in good hands. You know, do this, you know, and follow, you know, follow my guidance. But, you know, the other side of it is do what you want to do here. It's your class, you know, but I'm the guide. So, you know, let's go.
Yeah. So, okay, there's one more thing I'm curious about. You finished the book with this chapter talking about the yugas, and I don't know, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
So I was unfamiliar with this term, and you say we're moving towards the age of Aquarius, leaving Pisces, and that there's four stages. We're leaving the darkness. And you also say meditation is the answer. That's great. So I don't know. Can you just say a little bit more about the yugas and this place that we're in? I certainly hope that we're leaving the darkness. It kind of feels like we're going deep into it, but maybe things have to get that way first. Yeah. Can you explain a little bit about that?
I just found this information, again, so fascinating. So the yoga tradition doesn't think of time in a linear fashion, like we think of, you know, humanity started as cave people and then worked their way up to how we are now, you know, are technologically advanced. The yoga tradition doesn't think that way, and doesn't, their history is not like that. And as well as a lot of indigenous cultures, you know, it's more circular, cyclical, and the yogis break it down into yugas, which is Sanskrit for ages. So into four, each cycle is four ages or yugas. Now, one cycle is about 24,000 years. It's based on where we are in the universe. So it's based on the constellations, basically, Right now we're in Pisces. We stay in, it's the constellation that's when the sun rises, that's in the foreground. So that's how it's determined, just where we are, like positioned in the stars in the sky. So that'll stay like that for 2,000 years and move out slowly. And then Aquarius is the next constellation that'll be there. And so each constellation about 2,000 years. So to get through the whole 12 zodiac or star constellations takes about 24,000 years. So that's one cycle. And within that 24,000 years, it's also called the precession of the equinox is what that's called, that 12 periods. So in that period, there's four yugas, and the Kali yuga is the darkest. And then there's a golden age. I can't think of the name right now. And then two sort of in between ages. Now, this is kind of debated. Like, there's a lot of different yoga traditions that say what year we're in or where we're going. I based my research on an Indian sage, saint, astronomer called Sri Yukteswarji. He was the guru of Paramahansa Yogananda, autobiography of a yogi. So it was his guru. And he wrote this book, Holy Science. It's where a lot of this information is, if you're interested. It's a little thin little book. Mm-hmm. So it's his calculations, basically. And in his calculations, right now, we're coming out of the dark age. So it's the Kali Yuga into that, I'm going to say the Sanskrit, I apologize. It's like Dwaparu age, coming out of that, going toward the golden age. Phew. So thank goodness. Mm-hmm. So he says the darkest year in this age was 500 AD. So we're quickly moving away from the darkness. So people are naturally being drawn to subjects like expanding your awareness, consciousness, yoga, meditation, that it's a natural thing that people are trying to open their awareness. And according to the yoga tradition, our abilities will expand as well. Our more subtle abilities, like our intuition, things that we think are not our capability, actually will become as we move toward this light. And this isn't the first yuga. There were, I think, at least four before, where people got to quite high levels of advancement, maybe not so technological, but we have the pyramids, for instance, looking at us. You know, they don't really make sense according to a traditional look at history. So it's nothing to believe in or anything like that. It's just a different perspective. This is what yoga teaches, and I think it's fascinating. And I'm glad we're going in the good direction and the not good direction. But the teachings basically are there for the dark times so that people know it's just a period that we're in. You can still, according to the yogis, you can still achieve self-realization or your own personal potential, even in the darkest period. It's just harder and less people are with you. You know, now it's like people are coming together and you're more working with the momentum, which is easier. So a little bit of hope there.
Yeah, no, that's so fascinating. Okay, so if I understand correctly, there's the cycle, and that cycle will begin again. So once there's the dark age, and then there's two in between ages, and then there's the golden zone, golden time. Yeah. And then that after that golden time's over, the cycle begins again and moves towards darkness. Yeah. Obviously, this is kind of a slow morphing transition. But as it's continuing, we're continuing to advance. Would you say that is true? Like even like say four yugas ago, are we more advanced or not?
Well, I think that this is my opinion. This is a realm of learning that we are come here to learn, depending on our what we want to learn, how quickly we want to learn. So I think it's our choice to come at different times and experience different times. So I think this realm, this planet, whatever, it's providing these times for all of us to learn, to work out our karma, to advance. I don't think you necessarily have to come back or not, or, you know, if it's our choice. So it's not like we're in this wheel of prison, you know. We have our cycles that we have to get through in advance, and perhaps that's true. I don't know, but I feel like we learn from in this realm. I call it a realm, but this lifetime or lifetimes, and it certainly provides a lot of opportunity for growth and learning, for sure.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's so fascinating. Well, I feel like that's a nice place to end this. A little bit of hopefulness coming out of the darkness and a place for growth and learning. Yeah, thanks, Pamela, for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this interview. Please consider leaving a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And I hope we meet again soon, sometime on your mat.
Are you enjoying this podcast? I've chosen to offer these audio recordings freely for over 15 years. I do this because research shows yoga, yoga nidra, and Feldenkrais to be valuable practices, those which I would like to share widely. Dana, the Buddhist practice of generosity, has always been a pillar of my business. And more generally, Dana is the inclination to give without expecting any form of repayment. It does, however, take a fair amount of time, effort, and cost to maintain and keep the podcasts available. If you feel you've benefited from what you've learned from these classes, then please do consider making a contribution towards the maintenance and upkeep of the classes. It will help ensure that I can continue to offer the podcast classes freely and keep generating new material. Give what you can. Give what feels good. If it's too little, it won't feel good. If it's too much, it won't feel good. Links to support the show monetarily can be found in the show notes. And other ways to give include sharing the podcast with others, leaving a 5-star rating and review, or just sending me an email with how the classes have affected you. Thanks so much.